as we started yesterday, the goal, our goal, is to understand strongly coupled quantum field theory, to learn about quantum field theory beyond what we can do now. And that is a hard question. If I ask what is the spectrum and what are the couplings of some strongly coupled quantum field theory, it's a very tough question. And it's a hard question if we are dealing with, say, pure glue, which is the prototypical example where I ask what's the ratio of glue ball masses and so on. But even in more mundane field theories like the Ising field theory, we are slightly away from the critical temperature and with a non-zero magnetic field, even in two dimensions, it's a theory where we have no analytic control over its mass spectrum and its various couplings. So what we decided to do is to start thinking whether, instead of asking such sharp questions about the spectrum, whether we could ask some more humble questions, such as what are bounds on the possible spectrum and on the possible couplings. And this could be some upper bound, for example, on the couplings. Or if we ask many questions, perhaps we can start forming small islands. And the hope would be, of course, that the exact value is inside and the islands are so small that there is not a particularly big difference between bounds and exact results. This is the motivation, and the reason why we are optimistic that such thing could work is, of course, very much related to recent developments in the conformal bootstrap, where people have been pushing this idea of bounds, and indeed, they have managed to find archipelagos of field theories and very small islands. And even when there are not islands, you find that these bounds have particular features, and you can locate interesting theories at the boundary of them. So the prototypical example of the kind of question we are going to ask is, suppose I have some scattering process, and I scatter four identical massive particles, and let M1 be measured in units of M, be the mass of the lightest particle which is exchanged. So the first pole in the S matrix where S is the center of mass energy. And then I ask, what's the maximum coupling that can appear? The intuition being that if the coupling is bigger, it will decrease M1. Okay? So for a given M1 over M2, what is the maximum coupling? And the idea, what we said, is that, well, even though it might sound a bit counterintuitive, probably this S matrix bootstrap in the dimensions might be contained in a massless conformal, that is, a massless conformal bootstrap in D-1 dimension. The reason being that if you have a quantum field theory, we can put it in the box, study what happens to its boundary correlators, prepared in a way that the scattering happens in a region inside, and this correlation function defines a four-point function where four points are labeled now by coordinates on a D-1 dimensional space-time. And this four-point correlation function obeys the axioms of a conformal theory, and we can use the conformal bootstrap to maximize the three-point coupling given some external dimensions of these operators. And then we knew how to translate this CFT data into flat space data, namely the three-point function we translate into the coupling after removing the propagation inside the bulk, and the ratio of dimensions we translate into the ratio of masses of the various particles, as we take the dimensions to be very large. So we implement this numerical bootstrap. We study it for large dimensions. And two things could happen. One could be that there are no bounds, that as you take this limit of flat space, the bounds go to infinity. That would be totally consistent with there would be no logical problem with that. Or we could be lucky, and it seems like we are lucky, that plateaus form. This limit exists. And we manage to extract, indeed, maximum values for a coupling G as a function of M1 over M2. So for example, for square root of 3, I remember that if this is a log G here, that I think, for example, log of 10 is up here. For example, so there is no theory where a coupling is log of 10 and the mass exchange is square root of 3. Okay, that would be the claim. Okay, so now today I want to try to address this problem, not by going to ADS, but rather by attacking it directly in flat space. And this is, like the previous part, work we have been doing with John, Balt van Ries, Miguel Paulus, and Jerome Benedans. So here, we wanted to go and directly think about the S-matrix bootstrap in flat space. And I started by recalling a few basic things about S-matrices. Actually, there is one very basic thing that I did not recall, which I wrote here in different color, which is that in two dimensions, when we scatter two particles, the momenta, individual momenta, is conserved. So this is a particular feature of two dimensions. The phase space is such that if the particles are identical, P1 is P1 prime and P2 is P2 prime. So in two dimensions, if you think of the usual Mandelstam variables, S is 4 minus T and U is 0. Okay? there were three things, three comments I made yesterday, just to recall that. One was that stationary wave functions and S matrices are not such independent things. Even though one is stationary and the other is describing some evolution from minus to plus infinity, they are roughly the same thing. And this S matrix is the same S matrix that we discuss when we write pictures like the one there. The second thing was that we said that if we make complex momenta such that we make a decaying wave function, in other words, a bound state, this only works if we are allowed to kill this term, which means that we have to go to poles of the S matrix. So poles of the S matrix were bound states. Next, we saw that in an integrable theory, we have a bunch of a sum of six terms with all possible permutations. And that structure implies that the S matrix of a bound state with a fundamental particle, it's not a new object, but I can obtain it by fusing two S matrices of fundamental with fundamental. And the physical intuition from this factorization is that you can imagine that you have two bound states, two particles that will form a bound state. They have the moment, the right momenta to form a bound state. They are flying in space. Eventually, they meet and they form a bound state. But they could scatter with this particle after or before they form a bound state. And this leads to this formula here. OK. So we are going to bootstrap S matrices. And the first thing I would like to do is to show you some S matrices, because it's good when we want to bootstrap a general family of S matrices to have at least one example in mind such that we know a little bit what kind of animals we are dealing with. So here is a simple example of an S matrix. Okay? And I will tell you which theory it corresponds to in a minute. But for now, just think of it. I will write you an S matrix that obeys all the axioms it should obey and so on for an example for a 2-2-2 S matrix. So I'm writing a 2-2-2 S matrix. So in pictures, it's this. But now, finally, in formulas, it's very, very explicit. I want to write sine sinh of theta plus I sine of gamma over sinh of theta minus I sine of gamma. And now I'm going to explain a little bit the notation and tell you why this guy has the right analytic properties and so on to be an S matrix in two dimensions. OK. So let me introduce just some notation. This function, I want to call it f index gamma. Gamma is a real number. OK, so first, what is this theta? What is this theta here? So theta is what's called the rapidity. And it is a useful parameterization of the momentum of the incoming particle. If I say that my momentum p1 is m cosh theta 1 m sinh theta 1, and similar for p2, then theta is theta 1 minus theta 2. So theta is a convenient parameterization, because under boosts, these thetas are just translated, so this is a Lorentz invariant. And indeed, if I compute the usual Mandelstam variables, s, which is the center of mass energy, so I add up these two vectors, I get 4. Now I'm setting m to 1, cosh square of theta over 2, and t is 4 sinh square of theta over 2. So you see, it's a useful parameterization of the Mandelstam variables, and as I said before, u is equal to 0. So you see that s plus t add up to 4. Okay? Good. So this is a convenient parameterization. So what are the analytic properties of this function as a function of s, of the center of mass energy, which is the usual thing we think of? So you see that as a function of s, so this S matrix, it has a cut starting at the position 2m square. It has a cut starting at 0. And it has two poles. Okay? The two poles are at the values theta equal I gamma and theta equal I pi minus gamma. Okay? And this translates into these singularities. Okay? So there is a cut starting at the particle production threshold. So when you produce two particles, there is a cut here, which is the cut, when t is bigger than 2m square, whereas this is the cut when s is bigger than m squared, and this cat translates this relation into s smaller than 0. And the physics of these singularities are clear. They all describe on-shell processes. This one describes the creation of a pair of particles that is propagating. This one describes a pair of particles that is propagating in the T-channel. And this pole would represent a bound state, a single particle propagating. And this one would represent a single particle exchange in the T-channel. And there is a symmetry here. There is an S goes to 4 minus S symmetry. And this symmetry is just crossing symmetry because we have identical particles. So this symmetry is just a symmetry that amounts to seeing your diagrams from the side or from the bottom. It is just crossing symmetry, which you see that in this notation is something very simple. It is just theta goes to I pi minus theta. You can see that under this transformation, you flip S and T. Okay, this flips S and T. Okay, so in terms of theta, which is a very convenient variable because it gets rid of these cuts, this plane here, which is called the physical sheet, becomes mapped into a, what is called a physical strip, where you have a strip where this point is 0, this point is I pi, and this region here, between zero, where the imaginary part of theta is between 0 and I pi, is mapped to the full F-plane. Okay? And the poles that we have there are now in this line between 0 and I pi. And if I call these regions here A, B, right above the cut, C, D, then let me not do a mistake, A, B, C, D, I have, I'll probably do a mistake, but okay, A, B, then crossing goes from A to C, so C, D. Okay? Sorry? What's the question? Sorry?
No, I think there should be N squared.
Yeah, I said M equal to 1 here. The external mass is always set to 1. We always measure things in units of the external mass. I just wrote M here so that people would recognize this formula. But no, theta is convenient whenever you describe elastic scattering. So if you have, for example, scattering even in two dimensions, but where you have particles type AB go to CD, this theta is no longer very useful. So theta is useful if you have elastic scattering. And the reason is that theta is locking particle 1 incoming with particle 1 outgoing. And if you want to bring particle 1 to the back and particle 2 to the future, it's just a rotation in theta. But if you don't have elastic scattering, the relation between the moment is more complicated, and you want some other parameterization that implements crossing in a more natural way.
But for this 2 to 2,
right? For this 2 to 2,
is it always good theta, that the theta plane is periodic? So here you can speak back, but the expression is periodic in theta.
No, the expression doesn't need to be periodic in theta. No. Here, for example, you can, in this position, for example, if you study, let's see here, minus I pi plus a real number. If you take that S matrix, for example, here, now there are zeros, but no poles, for example, for that S matrix here. If you would continue going down, then in this case, it would be periodic. I'm not imposing it to be periodic. I'm not saying it is periodic. In general, going down means you start going through the cuts. So anything can happen. So as I'm going down, I'm not telling you what is happening there. I'm just saying that here, it should be a nice meromorphic function in this strip. Outside, it should not be. And indeed, in many examples, it gets complicated and it exhibits no periodicity as we go down. Very good. So I did not tell you, indeed, this is an example. As we will see, this is an integrable example. And let's see how we would see what you just said. So the point was that here we don't see a sign of a cut with 3 particles, 4 particles, 5 particles. And indeed, you can check the following immediately. You can check that, so you see S bigger than 4, which means that you are scattering a physical process, right? So your energy is bigger than 2, M. So this is energy square. For S bigger than 4, this means theta real, right? Theta, if theta is real, S is bigger than 4. And you can see, so you are on this line here, This is the physical line, the line of physical processes. And you see right away that absolute value of S of theta is equal to 1 on this line. So you go from 2 to 2, and you are maximizing you are already saturating unitarity. So there is no room for any part, for two particles going into 4 or into 6 or into 8. So from here, we see that this is a theory that S2 to N, where N is bigger than 2, we are studying theories without particle production. So this is probably an integrable theory indeed. Okay? So let me go on just telling you a few more words about this parameterization. So I just wanted to spend a few to point out that look what this theta goes to I pi minus theta. It's something, it's doing something very simple. That if you take, say, p1 mu, and you take its theta, we can take either theta 1 or theta 2. Suppose we take theta 1 to I pi minus theta 1, right? What we do is just flip this two momenta. So what this crossing does is you have your S matrix, and you have particle 1. And what you are doing is bringing particle 1, you are implementing exactly crossing in bringing particle 1, which had positive energy, now it goes to the past. And this particle 1, which had positive energy, now goes to the future. So it's really implementing crossing in the usual sense. So this is how we see that this parameterization in theta becomes quite convenient in this particular case. So what do we have for this S matrix? So as we said, we have, so what two properties this S matrix obeys? It obeys crossing symmetry, I already pointed out, which is S gets exchanged with 4 minus S, which in terms of theta gets translated into the equation S of theta is S of I pi minus theta. You can check that this S matrix has this property. If I change theta by I pi minus theta, indeed that function is invariant. And the second property is unitarity. Unitarity. And unitarity tells you that if you have S of theta times S of minus theta, this, or rather, yeah, okay, S of theta times S of minus theta should be equal to some function F of theta, which should be between 0 and 1 for real theta. 1 being the case where you maximize unitarity, and this is the case that we saw here. It actually, in this theory, it's actually equal to 1 here. But in general, the claim is that it should have been a function f that had to be between 0 and 1. And if it was less than 1, it means that we have possibility of scattering into other stuff. The fact that it is exactly 1 means that in this theory, if I prepare these two particles, I can only receive these two particles. Okay, so this would be, let's call this some absorption factor. And it would be allowed, there would be no problem, it just turns out to be 1, so this theory saturates unitarity, but it could be fine if this was some function. Typically, this function would be something that goes to 1 asymptotically, but otherwise, otherwise it could be below 1. Okay, so this is an example of an S matrix. It's a typical S matrix of the kind of things that we will analyze. It has poles. Then it has these two particle creation cuts. And it could have more cuts. In principle, what could happen is that here you could have more cuts opening up for multiparticles. But at least we have one cut starting here, some discontinuity, some poles between these points, and no more poles in the physical strip. So that's the assumption. Of course, if somehow we start finding other kind of analytic behavior, we are not dealing with these kind of theories. So translated into theta, what we are saying is that we study theories where we have a meromorphic function in the strip with eventually poles between 0 and I pi. Okay? So that's our setup. We want to study meromorphic functions with poles between 0 and I pi. So now let me tell you what this theory describes. So let me tell you what theory corresponds to this S matrix. So for example, to be specific, let me try gamma. For example, let me choose this gamma to be 2 pi over 3. Okay? So if this gamma is 2 pi over 3, you see that you have a pole at theta equal to 2 pi over 3 times I, and at theta equal I pi over 3. So these are the S and T poles. Okay? And let's discuss in a minute who is the S pole and who is the T pole. I'm not saying that one is S and one is T yet. Okay, so then this describes the S matrix of Sine Gordon. I'll tell you what Sine Gordon is in a second, with a coupling G of 2 pi over 3. There's another theory which it has the same S matrix, which is Sine Gordon with a coupling G of pi over 3. And then here is another theory which has the same S matrix, which is the Yang-Li model, which is the model that you get by starting with Ising field theory and turning out complex magnetic field and going to approaching a singular point. And as you approach the singular point, you have a massive integrable field theory, which is non-unitary because you turn on a complex magnetic field. And it's also described by this S matrix. Okay? So now I want to point out, I'll tell you what these theories are, what these two Sine Gordons, which have different couplings, so they are different theories are, and what this one is. But I want to point out already something. So this one is unitary and S bound states. Okay? This one is unitary and S no bound states. And this one is not unitary and S no bound states. Very good. So we have to understand all these questions. So we have to understand how come there are poles and it has no bound states, how come it's not unitary, and so on. So now I'll tell you a few things about how could it be that the same S matrix, I look at this S matrix, I try to interpret its physics. We thought this argument of being poles was totally bulletproof, but as I will tell you, actually things can be a little bit more subtle, so it's good to know this example so that we are aware of the kind of subtleties that could emerge. Okay. So let me say a few words first about the Sine Gordon theory. So one way of constructing Sine Gordon, which is quite cute in view of integrable theories, goes as follows. Suppose I want to start to consider to construct a very simple quantum field theory. Okay? So that's our goal. We want to construct simple quantum field theory. So we say, let's start with a Lagrangian, which contains a free scalar with some mass and some quartic interaction. Then we take this field theory, we take this theory, and we study what happens when we have some two particles producing four particles. We start summing the diagrams to study what's the S matrix for two particles producing four particles. Okay? And we observe something nice if we do this computation at tree level. We see that this quantity is non-zero, but even though it is non-zero, it's almost zero. And in fact, you can make it zero by adding an alpha prime phi to the 6. It's, even though it is non-zero, it is a constant. It's independent of the moment of the external guys. So you can cancel it completely by just a contact phi to the 6 interaction. So what you do is you tune this guy, tune it to cancel particle production. Yeah, it is very special to two dimensions. So you tune it to cancel particle production. And then you study 2 to 6, and now you have particle production. So what you do is you add an extra term, alpha prime prime phi to the 8, and this guy you tune to cancel particle production. And you go on. And then what you get is that this resums into a potential V of phi, which is a cosine of phi. Okay? And I will put some constants here. It's convenient to use this normalization, B A over B squared.
That first diagram I would think has a pole from the intermediate state.
Yeah, there are other guy diagrams that have the same pole. And okay, that's a very, so let's expand that a little bit. So what happens is that indeed you are pointing out there is a pole here, 1 over p squared. But there are other diagrams that have this pole. And it turns out that there are simple identities, like identities that you probably know, these kind of things. They are x minus y times z minus w. And you add a bunch of terms like this, and there are identities, such things add f to zero. Then you are happy that you draw these kind of diagrams and you get zero. However, there is a subtlety, which is here, this guy is not zero. What if here, at some point, this guy could become on shell? And it could really, and it could be that these I epsilons are important? And if you do the analysis, you see that if you study 2 to 4, it never happens. These I zeros are never important. But if you bring this guy, if you bring it to the past, now this guy can definitely become on shell. Okay? Then what you get is that even though 2 to 4 is 0, you cannot conclude that 3 to 3 is the analytic continuation and is also 0. Instead, what you derive is that for this theory, S3 to 3 is equal to the usual conservation of energy and usual conservation of momentum. This is built in. You start and your Feynman diagrams compute what multiplies this. But because of these cancellations with this delicate I0, what happens is that you get an extra delta function to put this particle online by adding two poles with different I0s. So you get an extra delta function, which is exactly the type of delta function that appears in an integrable model and that tells you that the momenta are just permuted, times a product of 2 to 2 S matrices. Because as soon as it factorizes, you are guaranteed that what appears on the two sides are 2 S matrix elements. So this theory, you see that no particle production and factorization are very intimately related. So this is a cute theory where we have no particle production, but we have a 3 to 3 scattering. Apparently, I learned recently that there is some people studying axiomatics of quantum field theory where they study exactly these kind of things, that indeed there can be, it's common that when you have a general scattering process of 3 to 3 particles in a general quantum field theory, the way to think about it is that any scattering process of 3 to 3 in any two-dimensional quantum field theory is a sum of two terms. This term and one which does not contain an extra delta function and one which is regular. So there is like, it's not a disconnected part, but there is a factorized part plus another part. And when you do crossing symmetry, the regular part is like a regular function that you analytically continue. You can cross and go from 3 to 3 to 2 to 4 and so on. So if you don't have particle production, you want to kill the regular term. And then you get just this, and these are what integrable theories are. OK. Anyway, so this is a theory, this Fine-Gordon theory. It's an interesting theory because you see that this phi has a kind of a natural periodicity. And then if we ask, what are these excitations of this theory? We see that there are two types of excitations. One excitation, which you just say phi is phi plus delta phi, the usual excitation of phi. You just expand around phi equals 0 and quantize. So the usual excitations, these delta phi excitations, are called breeders. And there are also other type of excitations, which are called the kinks. The kinks are simple to understand. We have our field phi. And you see that phi equals 0 or phi equals 2 pi, OK, not 2 pi, but 2 pi over b. Both are field configurations with zero energy, right? If I put phi equal constant, I have zero energy. But I can have some vacuum, and then I can have some phi, and then switch to another phi, and this would be a kink, and this domain wall could move with some velocity parameterized by some rapidity theta. Okay? This would be phi. So these are the kinks, and in fact, the breeders are bound states of kinks. So we can think that a breeder is like a kink that forms and annihilates. So this is what how we should think of a breeder, and it moves with some velocity theta. And in fact, if we scatter breeders as incoming states, we just get breeders. So we can focus on the theory of the breeders. So we can scatter two breeders going into more breeders and just study breeders. And now, depending on B, depending on this value of B, the number of bound states that you have changes. Okay? So there is a simple parameterization that goes between this B and this gamma, the gamma that appears in the S matrix that I don't want to write. I don't care about it. But that tells you that the number of breeders is, so a breather have an index n, and then runs, there are one breather, first breather, second breather, and it goes up to pi over gamma, integer part of pi over gamma. Okay? So you see that if gamma is very small, there are many, many breathers, but if gamma approaches pi over 2, for example, bigger than pi over 2 or something like that, there are already just one breather, just a fundamental breather, and there are no bound states of breathers. Okay? Good. So we see that when gamma is equal to 2 pi over 3, if I did no mistake here, there should be two breathers. Is it true? Oh my God, it doesn't look to be the case. I'm afraid I should get two breathers. Do I get? No. When gamma is pi over 3, I get two breathers. I even get three, right? Okay. So I swapped. What was I saying before? Where is it? Yeah, this is pi over 3. This is 2 pi over 3. So you see that when it's pi over 3, we have bound states. We can scatter two breathers and get two, we can get a breather of type 2. So when this gamma, we have this process where we scatter n equal 1, and we get here n equals 2. But when gamma is 2 pi over 3, we only have n equal 1. Okay? So we have no bound state there. Okay. We can also see. Yeah, okay. Okay. You can easily see that in this case, if you work out the mass, how do I work out the mass of this particle? You see, I can, for example, check easily that if I take m cosh, and I go to the position of that pole to form the bound state, so I do I get, so this thing here is the mass of the breather M2. Okay? Okay, it will be square root of 3 times M. So in this case, where we have a breather, everything looks kosher. We have breathers, they scatter, they form a bound state, which is the second breather. That breather decays. I could now compute the residue. And in this case, we can compute the residue when theta goes to I pi over 3 of that S matrix, and it behaves like 1 over I times some positive number divided by theta minus I pi over 3. And this thing here would be related up to some simple Jacobian to the coupling that we want. Okay? And everything would be okay in this case. Okay, so, however, what happens? Is that, in fact, singularities in two dimensions, we can have poles that do not correspond to bound states, and that correspond to other processes. And the reason is very simple. So what is a singularity? How do we understand what singularities appear in an S matrix? As we said before, we analyze Landau diagrams. We study all possible diagrams where all lines are on shell, and this gives us the loci of all possible singularities, right? So this bound state is a particular example of an on-shell process. But suppose we consider the following on-shell process, where I consider this diagram here, where I have these triangles here. Okay? So suppose this is S, and I want to see what's the effect of this on-shell process. And you see from this cartoon, if I imagine cutting here, this looks like a two-particle cut. And indeed, if you study this diagram in, say, a four-dimensional theory, this would give rise to a square root cut discontinuity starting at the particle threshold. Okay? But here you see that something happens different in two dimensions. So let's make a rough estimate of what singularity this could give rise to. Well, we have each line, we use the usual Kutovsky rules to estimate the discontinuity, we replace by a delta function that sets this momentum on shell. So we have 6 delta functions, and we have 2 integrations, so 2D integrations, where this is 4, because we are in 2 dimensions. And you see, therefore, that after the integrations, we are left with 2 delta functions. And of course, this is in striking contrast if it was in 4 dimensions. In 4 dimensions, we would have more integrations than delta functions, and we would get something finite. So what function has a discontinuity, a delta function? It's a pole, right? If you have a pole, it's exactly what we were discussing before with this particle production, right? A discontinuity of a pole is exactly a delta function, right? So these 2 delta functions is exactly the sign of a double pole, if we do this carefully. For example, so here is an example of a diagram, and here is an example of something that could happen. You could, in 2 dimensions, your estimators could have double poles, something that looks very weird. And these double poles are nothing esoteric. They are the manifestation of a 2-particle contribution. Okay? Another intuitive way of thinking is thinking, what is this? What are these Landau diagrams? They are just like Legos. You just have some building blocks where you have some on-shell processes, right? And you glue stuff such that you have momentum conservation. So things are rigid, right? So when you are in higher dimensions, when you are gluing some 3-dimensional Legos, you can deform things. But if you are in the blackboard, as soon as you find some configuration, because it's in 2 dimensions, you have no rigidity. So the configurations which are on shell are discrete instead of continuous. And therefore, instead of cuts, we typically get poles in 2 dimensions. It's because of this rigidity, inherent rigidity of 2 dimensions. So here is an example of a double pole, but we could find other examples that give single poles or even cubic poles or 12th order poles. And we just have to be careful that when there is a pole, we cannot immediately associate to it a bound state. Sometimes it corresponds to multi-particle contributions, and the way they manifest themselves, it is just a bit different in 2 dimensions. And indeed, what happens is exactly that for this theory. We have a unitary theory. It has no bound states. And indeed, you can check that for this particular value, you can form such triangle diagrams and explain the singularity in a totally different way. Because you see, whether you can or not draw these diagrams depends on the mass spectrum. What can happen is that, as I said, this is rigid. So for example, what do you need to be able to form this diagram? You need this angle to be smaller than pi over 2, otherwise it opens. So you can see that this angle is smaller than pi over 2 in the second option, but bigger than pi over 2 in the first one. So in the first one, where you already explained the pole and you want nothing else, you are happy. In the second one, the pole leaves, and luckily this triangle shows up to save the day. Okay? Okay, so we killed one paradox, but we raised another paradox. Because then you say, but what about the other argument where I could just go to the pole of the S matrix and form a decaying wave function and get a bound state, right? So now you could say, well, I have this Sine-Gordon theory, and this will be the wave function when I have my points x1 very separated from x2. And in both cases, the S matrix is the same. So this guy has the same poles. So I would think that I can go to the same complex values and form the same bound state. So this gets confusing. Who forbids me, from this point of view, of forming this bound state? Why am I allowed in one case and forbidden in the other? What could happen? Right? So it gives rise to this other puzzle. I'm just highlighting particularities of 2 dimensions. In the end, everything will be simple, but I'm just pointing out that 2 dimensions sometimes is a bit subtle. And the point is something that we also learned, which is that poles in the S matrix is a necessary condition, but it's not a sufficient one. Because what happens is that this wave function, it only takes this form if the particles are very well separated. Otherwise, there is, if you want, some profile here, some function f of x1 minus x2. This function will approach 1 at infinity, but otherwise could have some different behavior as you move in x. And here there would also be some function f of x1 minus x2, and this could depend on the momenta k1 and k2. This is a more realistic situation if your particles are not point-like. If your particles have some typical length, like here they do, these breathers, they have some typical wavelength, you expect that this function f, the wave function, will be significantly modified if the breathers are very close to each other. Okay? So now, the point is the following. The claim is the following. Is that you should be careful, because there are two limits you can do. You can take the limit when k1 and k2 go to the values of the bound state, and then you separate the particles. Or you can first separate the particles, which is what we did here, and then go to the values of the bound state. Okay? And the claim is that they don't commute. So the claim is the following. Is that if I go to this wave function, the claim is that even though the S matrix is invariant under gamma goes to pi minus gamma, and therefore the S matrix cannot distinguish between these two situations, the claim is that this function f will be able, this function f will really depend on gamma, and this function f will be such that it should do the following. When gamma is such that you have a bound state, nothing should happen specially, and indeed you can replace this f by 1, and the previous conclusion should hold. But when gamma is such that you don't expect bound states, what should happen is that as you are taking this complex momenta to these values, the regime of validity of this approximation should become smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and you should not be allowed to form the bound state. Okay. So I think this is the only consistent picture, but I should also say that it's not like we have lots of exact wave functions that we could check this on. So in fact, the only example we know is a very contrived example, but it's the only example where we knew of the exact wave function that we could test this hypothesis. So one S matrix that we know exactly, and when we also know its exact wave function, is the wave function for excitations on the chromodynamic flux tube of n equals 4 super Young Mills. So it's not the same, but you can take the chromodynamic flux tube, put two scalars on the flux tube, let them move and scatter with each other. And if you look at that S matrix, it has poles, and it looks like these guys can form bound states. But we know they cannot. We know that if we analyze the spectrum of the theory has no bound states. And in that case, we could indeed analyze precisely the wave function. These functions we could compute exactly. There were some hypergeometric functions that go to one at large distances. And what happens is that with these hypergeometrics is that an hypergeometric is something which is one plus this x is the small parameter when the distances are large times some parameters, one over some Pockhammer stuff. And this Pockhammer stuff was starting to diverge exactly as you form the bound state. So as you are going to the bound state, this approximation that was telling you that you could take the one and separate the particles is becoming worse and worse and worse. And more than that, if you really take the exact wave function and take the momentum to the bound state, the exact wave function was going to zero, showing that indeed you form no bound state at all. So I don't think there's any contradiction with this. This should be the typical thing that can happen. Okay, so to summarize, what we are going to look is for singularities in the S matrix for functions which are meromorphic and which have poles. And the S matrices we find might describe theories which have bound states, or might describe theories which have Kalman-Thun poles, or might describe other things. But it's the best we can do. It is just that the life of an experimentalist in two dimensions will be a tough life. He would have to do many, many experiments to distinguish between all these scenarios. Just with this S matrix of 1-1 goes to 1-1, you could not tell apart all these differences. And finally, let me mention the last case that we said. Exactly. How can we tell apart the pi over 3 and 2 pi over 3? We can tell them apart by the sign of the residue. So what happens is that at 1, you will have a residue which is g square over s minus m square. And in the other case, you will have a residue which will be g square over t minus m square. And t is 4 minus s. So the residue as function of s, in one case is positive, and in the other case is negative if you have a unitary theory. So this residue as function of s is positive, and this residue as function of s, because of the 4 minus s, is negative. So if you look at this S matrix, you can see that one of them corresponds to an S channel, and the other corresponds to a T channel exchange. And you see by seeing the sign of the corresponding residue. And you can see that the sign of, so one of them corresponds, so this one corresponds to a t-channel, and it corresponds to a mass equal to square root of 3. And this one would correspond to a mass equal to 1, and sorry, this is an s-channel, a mass equal to 1, and this would be the t-channel. Okay? So this theory has a pole, a mass square root of 3, and it has a t-channel exchange that the position is at s minus 1, but it corresponds to, I should not call it m equal 1. I should say s equal 1, which corresponds to t equals square root of 3 again. Okay? Is it okay? But you could now say, now this is where this Young-Li theory comes about. Young-Li is a theory where, in fact, the guy that is being exchanged is this one, which has mass 1, and this one is the t-channel. But then it has the wrong sign for the residue, but it's fine because the theory is not unitary. So Young-Li is the theory where these guys are exchanged. This is the Young-Li theory. So it's a theory where the residues come with the wrong sign and the theory is not unitary. So Young-Li is a theory where you perturb by magnetic field. So there is a cubic coupling now in the Ising model because you broke Z to symmetry by perturbing by magnetic field. And this cubic coupling between the four spins is exactly the coupling that you are measuring here, where you have an exchange of a particle of mass 1. So Young-Li is a non-unitary theory with a cubic coupling, but it is described by this S matrix that resembles that of a unitary theory. So in the Young-Li, you are exchanging a particle of mass 1. Okay. Good. So, so this is the world of two dimensions. I think I told you about the general features. I also told you about the particular features. And now I'd like to move really to the problem we want to solve and to try to to find the and tell you how we can solve it in a rather simple way, in fact. Okay. So, let's solve the following problem. Our goal is to say that we have an S matrix that obeys S of theta, S of minus theta equal to some absorption factor F of theta, that is between 0 and 1 for real theta. And it's crossing symmetric. And within this, we want to find what is the maximum coupling for a given pole structure in the complex plane between 0 and I pi. So I specify a bunch of poles. For example, one particle exchange that could correspond to a mass square root of 3, for example. I put a mass square root of 3, and I ask what's the maximum residue I could have with it. So this is the mathematical problem. Okay? So let's solve this mathematical problem now and forget about the physics. We understood the physics already. Okay? Well, first we see that we can split the problem into two steps. We can first find the particular solution when we have f, and I can then multiply this to a solution where f is equal to 1. Okay? So I can always think that S is S for this F, not equal to 1, times an homogeneous solution which corresponds to F equal to 1. Right? If I plug F equal to 1, if this S obeys the equation with F equal to 1, I can always multiply this by this and it still works. So let's start by discussing this one first. Okay. So S
might become non-unitary.
Sorry?
Might become non-unitary.
No. No, if absolute, no, if this times this, it might become non-unitary, of course, yeah, of course. But I'm saying now I'm forgetting, I'm just solving these equations here first, and then within the space of solutions to this equation, I will look for the condition on the residue. So the first, what is this S, this particular solution, where F is not equal to 1? Well, I can write it right away, so let me write it and then tell you why it is what it is. It is the integral d theta log of f of theta prime divided by sinh of theta minus theta prime plus I zero with some pi's. Okay. Two pi I and a minus sign. Okay. So this is the solution to this homogeneous solution. And indeed, it's easy to see why. So notice the following. Notice that these two equations here, we can check the following. You can check that these two equations, they imply in particular that S of theta plus I pi times S of theta equal to F. Is this correct? Maybe there is an over. Yeah, if I did not mistake, it should be correct. Equal to I to F of theta. Okay. And suppose I want to check this equation. So let's check that this goes through this equation. So if I take the log, I get log of F equal this log plus this log. No, notice what happens with the log of the S matrix, which is what is in the exponent. I get this term plus the same thing where I shift theta by I pi. So sinh is antiperiodic, so it looks like I get zero, right? Because sinh of theta is minus sinh of theta plus I pi. But of course, the issue is this I zero. I start slightly above the real axis, and I shift, and I go up to I pi minus I zero. So instead of getting a strict cancellation, I will get exactly a delta function. And I will get a delta function, and therefore this integral of this right-hand side will give integral of a delta function, and it will give me log of f. Okay? So this is indeed a particular solution to this equation. Okay? Now, we take this particular solution, S of theta, and we think of this solution as saying that I have some kind of function on the real axis, and this is kind of a propagator that takes this function and tells me what's the value of S at some point in the complex plane theta. Okay? So I want to now go to the complex plane and think at what could be the value of the S matrix at some point between 0 and I pi. Well, I just plug here theta equal I times t in this S matrix. And I use the fact that S is even, and I see that S between 0 and I pi, this SF at IT, is equal to the exponential of the integral d theta prime over 2 pi. And then there is the following quantity, sine of t, cosh of theta prime over absolute value of sinh of IT minus theta prime square times log of f of theta prime. And what I want to point out is that we see something nice. We see that this quantity is positive when t is between 0 and pi, right? Because it's a sine of t which is positive, a cosh that is always positive, and the kernel that is always positive. And log of f is negative because f is between 0 and 1. So this log of f is negative because f was an absorption factor between 0 and 1. So this S of f at it is smaller or equal than 1, this S of f of it. So we just derived something interesting. We derived that the optimal, that if you have a solution, if you put some minimal solution, you always decrease the magnitude of the function in this line. So if your goal is to maximize the residue, what we prove is that it's best to saturate unitarity and set f equal to 1 exactly. Okay? This is kind of intuitive. It's the statement that if you maximize unitarity, your S matrix can be bigger. Okay? So now we just found that the optimal solution should be just given by the homogeneous solution to this equation. It should be the homogeneous solution that satisfies the best bound. Now, what could be the homogeneous solution that satisfies this equation with f equal to 1? Well, that one is an example, this f gamma. F gamma is an example of a function that has f equal to 1, it has no absorption, and it obeys those equations with f equal to 1. But I can multiply 2 of them, or 3 of them, or 4 of them. So here is a large enough space of functions. And we are not trying to make this into a theorem, but probably it can be made into a theorem. But here is a large enough space of functions that probably parameterize the full space of solutions we can write. So we can do the following. We can say that S without this homogeneous solution with F equal to 1, I can multiply S a bunch of this. I should not use the same letter. F of gamma J product over J. And this, I choose these guys. This, all of them would obey this equation. I could also multiply a product of F with minus gamma J, negative minus. So these guys, they would introduce poles in the physical strip. These guys would introduce zeros. They are totally fine. They don't introduce poles. They don't introduce poles between 0 and I pi, but they put a 0 between 0 and I pi. Why not? A 0 of an S matrix is something fine. There's no objection to that. It's also natural to consider F of the gammas that would be minus I pi over 2 plus gamma J. These guys, we will in physics call them resonances. They are also below the physical strip, but there are singularities below the physical strip that you could put. You could not put with a plus I pi over 2, because those would be inside the physical strip. You don't want to put poles there. But if you went below the cut, it would be totally fine to put them at this value. It would give a unitary S matrix as well, and something OK. It corresponds to replacing the sign there by a cosh. So all these guys would be OK. And we could also multiply the S matrix by minus 1 to some number, which means, OK, minus 1 or plus 1. That would also be OK. But now we notice something. We notice that this F with the zeros, right? I can take that F there and go again, put theta equal to IT, and see what's the magnitude of an F0 between 0 and I pi. And I see that all these factors, the F absolute value of F gamma smaller or equal than 1. So each 0 that I put lowers the value of residues between 0 and I pi. Does it mean that I should put the zeros, remove them completely? No, I cannot. And the reason is that these poles, if I put the right poles, I'm not guaranteed that they come with the right signs. So the full solution is the following. First step, you put the poles you need. Then, if some poles don't come with the right sign, you put a zero between the poles. That will fix the sign of the pole. You put just one, because each one you put is costing you residue, so you don't want to exaggerate, so you just put one. And then where do you put it between the zeros? You just have one parameter maximization, you just find the optimal spot. And that's it. And resonances always cost you weight, so you never put them. So this also have smaller or equal than one. Okay? So the claim, as we said, is that the best bound is a product of F gamma J plus zeros if the sign of the residues is not okay. You see? Because imagine you want to extend a particle of mass 1 or a particle of mass square root of 3. As we saw before, they both have poles at the same positions, but we need to change the sign of the residues in one case. Right? So the claim is we could take this solution, from it extract G, and now we can plot this G as function of, say, M1 over M, in the case that we have just a single mass, for example. OK? So here is the problem. So let me turn it on and show you what we get. But while I do it, I want to say that this problem can also be solved. So this is the analytic solution. But there's also a numerical version of this bootstrap, even in flat space. The numerical version, and that's also why we did not make such a huge effort to convert this kind of thing into a theorem, because we had the numerics that were indicating that our solutions were OK. But the numerical version is very simple. So let me tell you what the numerical version would be in this case. Suppose I want to find the maximum coupling for this S matrix. So what would be the numerical problem? I would write a dispersion relation for my S matrix. I would say logarithm of my, or I would say my S matrix as function of Mandelstam variable, it can have a pole at S minus M of the bound state. This is this square root of 3. It can have a tuple, so at 4 minus s minus the mass of the bound state. And then it can have some dispersion relation starting at 4m squared up to infinity with some rho of x dx times 1 over, and it's just the continuum limit of this. So s minus x plus 1 over 4 minus s minus x. Well, this would be a dispersion relation for this guy, right? With a single pole. And then the problem mathematically is the following, is find what is the maximum value of G, okay? And you maximize by varying the space of functionals, the space of densities, rho. But I cannot put G arbitrarily large because I need such that when I check this condition, it must be smaller or equal than 1. So what do? We take this rho and we do a linear spline approximation to rho. So namely, we just have some rho and we specify some points. We discretize rho and say it's linear between any two points. Then you can compute this integral. Then this integral, after you linearize, becomes a sum of some ci that depend on s times rho at the values I, where you fix the function rho I. Right? So you get something linear times rho I. And then you impose this constraint that the absolute value of s squared smaller or equal than 1. What is this? This is just a bunch of circles, right? This is a circle. This is a bunch of spheres in this multidimensional plane of the rho I and the g. So in this multidimensional plane, what I'm doing is I'm imposing the constraints for many s's. So I think of it as many spheres. And I'm imposing that I'm inside all these spheres. So I'm inside this convex region here. And inside this multidimensional region, where this represents the space of all rows and all g's, I find where is the direction of increasing g, and I move until I hit the boundary. Okay? In Mathematica, this is called find maximum, comma, and then you put the condition. So you but this is what we are doing. And then, indeed, we reproduce the same solutions that we find from this analytic bound. But as I said, the bound is an analytic prediction that we can compare now with a conformal bootstrap. So why isn't it working? Presentation, screen. Okay. So now I'm going to plot an example of a more sophisticated case, because it's a cute plot, which is the case where we are exchanging two particles, one of mass m1 and one of mass m2. If you want to go to the previous case, you just send m2 to 2. So you send m2 inside the threshold, it disappears. Okay? But we will have a three-dimensional plot, and what we'll see is m1 and m2. M1 is the lightest one, m2 is the second lightest, and both are measured in units of m, which is the external guy. Okay, so maybe it's good to turn off these lights, no? How do we do it? Okay, so here is the plot that we get. So you see this is the mass m1, this is the mass m2. So both, this is the square of them, so both go from 0 to 4. This is not minus 10, this is 0, and the minus 1 is from this axis. So it goes between 0 and 4, this m1, and m2 goes between 0 and 4. And because m2 is bigger than m1, it's a triangle. And you see that here is the optimal bound. In blue, you have the S matrices that we found that optimize these bounds, are analytic S matrices. And one of them you see is exactly Sine-Gordon. Sine-Gordon is a theory that lies exactly on the bound of according to this logic. So you see that here you have this bound. And let's see that there are two interesting slices here. One slice, as we said, is when we put m2 equal to 2. So you look at the bottom wall, right? You look at the wall at the bottom. The wall at the bottom is the same plot that we saw yesterday. It's where we have just one particle being exchanged. And you see there is a cusp there in the middle. Okay? So that line we are going to compare next with the CFT points that we had yesterday. There is another interesting line, which is, for example, when you take m1 equal to 1 and study this this direction here, because that would be studying the space of theories which have a cubic coupling and asking what's the maximum cubic coupling as function of the next particle. It's also something very natural to ask. So let me plot these two slices. So as I said, one slice is the one we saw yesterday, which is the case where I have just one particle being exchanged. And here is the curve what we predict. And the second one is there is a cubic coupling. Okay, the second one, there is a what's the maximal cubic coupling given that there is a second mass M2. Okay? Okay, so for example, here is the comparison with the point of the bootstrap. You see, there is no fit. So the blue dots are the dots obtained from this bootstrap that obtained from the CFT bootstrap in one dimension. And the black curve is the analytic prediction. Here is the same thing for the other case where we have a cubic coupling plus a second mass. And again, these numerics now are a bit better. We have more digits now. But you see already that they match completely this curve. I don't know if I have the curve written, but it's a very non-trivial curve as a function of M. So here is another case. And in the remaining time of the talk, I want to spend a few time discussing this case. It's a pity I wanted to remove this dot from this plot to tell you a little bit about it. But here is an even more interesting case where we have three masses. So we have a mass M1, which is 1. So we study theories with a cubic coupling. And then on top of M1 being exchanged, there's also an M2 and an M3. Okay? So here is the space M2 and M3. M1 is equal to 1, so there is a cubic coupling. What we plot here is the maximum value of the cubic coupling. And there are these regions. And in particular, there is this rectangle here. And in this rectangle, the optimal bound we found is region B is the product of three F gammas. This notation is the same as F gamma. Okay? So I want to study this region B and tell you a little bit of the kind of things that we are thinking now on how we can go beyond these bounds. Because as you see, these bounds, they are the first sort I said. They just distinguish something forbidden from something forbidden from something potentially allowed. I want to see, how could we find more structure here? How could we go to this region B and look for this Ising model, for example? Okay? So how would we now start understanding particular nice features of this bound? Okay? So before I remove this transparency, let me just copy again, emphasize what I want to do. We want now to look at some region of this plot and try it asking how could we improve this bound, bring the bound down, and start asking more questions and isolating theories that we might be interested in. Okay. Okay, so we have this region B. Right? This region B is a rectangle where we have some mass M2 that is between square root of 2 and square root of 3, and the mass M3 that is between, that is bigger than square root of 3 and smaller than 2. Okay, so there is this triangle, this object here. Let me see. Okay, the way I drew it there, I chose the axis growing in the other direction. Square root of 2, square root of 3, and here 2, 1, 3. Okay, so you see that the particle M3, if the particle goes in this direction, it is going into the continuum. It is disappearing. It's approaching 2, so it's approaching the threshold. So a particle here is a particle that is close to disappearing. A particle M3 is close to disappearing, and M2 is between square root of 2 and square root of 3. Okay? You see, the reason why we have different regions is because as you move regions, sometimes you need to put extra factors to get the right signs, and then the bounds just change discontinuously. Okay? And in this region, the S that we found that seems to be the optimal, which is a function of theta, is a product of F gamma 1, F gamma 2, F gamma 3, where gamma 1 is 2 pi over 3, because we want to have a cubic coupling. So you remember that this angle gives rise to a cubic coupling where the mass is equal to 1. Right? In the previous example, interpreting that particle as that pole as being an exchange particle was wrong because the residue was wrong, but here it turns out to have the right sign. Right? Or I can, okay, not but to be maybe less confusing, I can say it's pi over 3 then. Okay? So we have this gamma is fixed, and these two are free parameters. And moving in this gamma 2, gamma 3 moves you in the space, right? This parameterize M2 is a function of gamma 2, and M3 is a function of gamma 3. Okay? So this is the optimal solution, the one that gives the optimal bound. Okay, so now I want to go back to the blackboard. Yes, yes.
G is the coupling to the first bound
in M2? G is the coupling to M1. So when we exchange, we have here M1 with coupling G plus, and we also have M2, and we also have M3. Those, they have their own couplings, but what we are doing is maximizing the coupling, this G between 1, 1, 1. Okay, we have to pick something, so we pick the first one, and the idea is that if 1, 1, 1 couple, if the cubic coupling is very big, this M2 and M3 should lower. So for a given M2 and M3, I should have a maximum 1, 1, 1. Indeed, that is what we find, and we have this solution. So this is the S matrix. It's more general than the coupling, but from this S matrix, you can extract a G maximum 1, 1, 1 by just computing the residue. Okay. So now let's start analyzing what happens here. So the first thing we see is that, as we said before, this S matrix, this S optimal, is a phase when theta is real, right? Its absolute value is 1. So this seems to be describing an integrable theory, since it means that there is no particle production, right? So it seems reasonable. We also have this S matrix contains a pole with a residue at theta minus 2 pi I over 3, and that's a cubic coupling. So we know that there exists a cubic coupling between three particles of the same mass. Okay? Now, there are two options. I can have particle M1, M1 producing a particle that can have the same mass as M1, but be a different kind of particle. It doesn't need to be the same sort. Or it can be a genuine cubic coupling. Okay? So now let's impose that it is a genuine cubic coupling. Let's impose these two conditions. If we impose integrability plus cubic coupling in this sense, that the particle exchanged is really the same as the external particle, we have a powerful constraint. Because then we have a following equation. It might be even written still there, it's still here. Then we have this very powerful equation here. Because then I get right away the following self-consistency equation. I must have that S of theta plus I pi over 3 times S of theta minus I pi over 3, which means I take a particle and form a bound state of ones, two ones getting back a one, must be equal to S of theta. Now, this is a very non-trivial constraint. So we go and impose this constraint on this solution here and see what it implies for gamma 2 and gamma 3. What we find is that when we do it, there is a region here. It's rather a line, but I'm drawing it as a region. This line is the possible line. So out of this full space, you need to be here on this line. So this line is where G111 is a cubic coupling, is a genuine cubic coupling, assuming the theory is integrable. If the theory is integrable, because if it's not integrable, I cannot say that fusion is this trivial. If I assume integrability and genuine cubic coupling, I rule out this full region to this line. Then, I want to see what happens as I move along this line. Okay? So what can we do? We can, along this line, we can construct now the bound state S matrices, because if the theory is integrable, I now go along that line and construct, for example, the S matrix for a scattering of a particle of mass M2 with a particle of mass M1. Right? This would be just a product. Let me even be explicit. I can be very explicit. It is theta plus I gamma 2 over 2 times S of theta minus I gamma 2 over 2. Okay? Actually, this was wrong. This 2 was important. Okay? If I want to have this notation, I want to keep like this. So you form this bound state with gamma 2. And in this way, you are constructing a particle of mass m2. You see, this is the pole. The pole is at gamma 2. Remember, there is the sign of gamma 2 there. Now, this is, as I said, the S matrix of a particle of type 2 and particle of type 1, whereas these two guys, I can add this index 1, 1 to indicate they are particles of type 1. And now, I can look and see where are the positions of the poles of this guy. And here is what I find. Here is what we find. So if we plot as a function of S, where are the poles of this object, we find the following. We find that there is a pole at 1. So that's fine. Because there was a pole at 1, there ought to be. Because we have 1, 2 can produce a 1 that decay again into a 1 and a 2. Because if this cubic coupling 1, 1 going to 2 existed, this process must exist. So there ought to be a pole there, because we already measured these couplings G times G. Not only is there a pole there, but the residue comes out with the correct residue being G112 squared. So this works out fine. Then we go, and we see that here is the mass M2. And there is a pole close to M2 at some position, M2 prime. And here is the mass M3. And here is a pole at a nearby position at some position, M3 prime. So we see that this theory, we detected new particles. We said that we started with particles 1, 2, 3. And now, in the scattering of bound state, new poles appeared. And now we detected new particles. We saw, well, this theory actually contains a particle of mass m2 prime and m3 prime that are close to m2 and close to m3, but not exactly the same. OK? But then we might now put an extra constraint. I might want to say, I don't want more particles below 2. I want this M2 prime to be M2 and this M3 prime to be M3. I want, by hypothesis, to say there are only three particles below 2. So now we impose that these new poles, MJ prime, equal to MJ. In this way, you find that there is a single point where that is true. And that marks a point here. Okay? This fixes a single point here. At this point, we have an integrable theory with just three particles of mass m1, m2, and m3, smaller than 2. And you can easily check that now if you construct s22, s32, s33, you don't produce new particles at slightly neighboring values. Whereas if you would move here, you would. So there's nothing wrong with moving here, provided you accept that there are many more theories below 0 and 2. But if your hypothesis is that there's only M1, M2, M3, you must be exactly at this point. What you do find is that if you construct the S matrix of 2, 2, yeah.
Did you really impose two conditions, or did you just impose M2 prime as M2 and the other one came for free?
Yeah, that's what happened, yeah. We imposed one condition, and then M2, the other one came for free. So we found, and then we checked, without any free parameters, that now, because now everything is fixed, right? All the gammas are fixed. We construct 2 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 3, and see that until 2, there are no new particles. And here is the masses that we find in this way. If we do this procedure and fix these values, we find these masses. We find M1 is 1, M2 is 1.618, M3 is 1.989. And then if we go and study, say, 2 to 2, it does have a new particle of mass M4. This M4, however, is bigger than 2. It's something that you would not see when you scatter 1, 1. And in fact, strictly speaking, it's only there because the theory is integrable. So you are allowed to scatter, say, 2, 2, 2s, and they will not fall inside the threshold of 1, 1 because 2, 2s don't produce 1s by integrability. So because the cut of 2, 2 only starts at 2, M2 and not at 2, M1, like in a regular theory, we have room for more masses. But you should think that the spectrum of masses is that there are three masses plus five masses. But these five are not really to be taken as seriously as these three. As soon as you perturb integrability, these guys will follow inside the continuum, and this would remain. These numbers are exactly the numbers for the masses of the Ising model with magnetic field. So these numbers were indeed conjectured by Zamolodchikov. They are exactly the values of the this point is the Ising model with magnetic field. So that's something that we found very cute. Then we said, well, but this is the Ising model with magnetic field. It's cute to reproduce it. But this one is the one that is known. This one was the one that Zamolodchikov had already predicted. What would be interesting is to ask what happens if I now turn on the temperature. What starts happening here? Well, as I said, no one knows. So this is now a tougher problem. So what we can do is the following. We go to our plot. So we have our 3D plot, right? There is some bound. And this point is Ising. What we can do is the following. People know what is the first variation of these masses as I turn on the temperature. So they know, as I turn on the temperature, what is delta M2 and delta M3 measured in units of M1 and M2. So this can be computed because you can do perturbation theory and perturb around this temperature equal to the critical temperature. Then what you can do is you can draw the direction, the slope, along which, turning on a thermal perturbation, you would move. And you can say, if I turn on a thermal deformation, I move to linear order in this direction. But you see that now you start sweating because something could go dramatically wrong. So if I compute the slope of this line, right, and draw a tangent to the slope of this line, it better be that the exact slope for the exact S matrix must agree exactly with our bound. Otherwise, as we would go slightly above or slightly below the critical temperature, if this slope is not exactly the same, it would violate the bound. So we can now go to this complicated surface, find the direction of the thermal deformation, compute the slope of the curve there. It gives some value like 8.563. And then compare with the computation of the perturbative S matrix that people also did, which is a much more complicated perturbation. Compute the slope there, and indeed it agrees perfectly with the slope that, that we have here, indicating that to linear order, the curve stays inside the bound. Of course, it should. So then what would be the hope? And the question. The question is, how do we now start injecting more structure on this plot? This is not what we would like. So if I see what would be the dream, would be instead of this plot to have some line which could respond to the Ising model. And this would be with critical temperature. And this would be with temperature turned on. And it would be nice if this 3D plot will have some kind of structure where it will be some kind of avenue and then something, some structure. And you would really see on the 3D plot that the plot went down everywhere except at the line. And you will see this line and say, oh, this is the critical model. Here are its couplings. Here are its masses, and so on. I think we have evidence that this should happen if we start now considering the bootstrap where we impose all correlators at the same time, not just M1s, but also M1, M2, and so on. Because here is already one example, for example. We already know that if I move along this orange line, right? And if I am assuming integrability, I'm violating the hypothesis of the spectrum right away. I cannot, because I generate this M2 prime and M3 prime. So I already have a hint that if I do this carefully, as I go along these directions, the plot ought to go down in both directions. So it's already indicating that there should be indeed some kind of cusp going down, and we should indeed be able to see this cusp, like we have some street, and then all streets go down from there. So that's basically what we are trying to understand. We are trying to understand whether by considering these multiple correlators, whether we can find even more structure and understand the solution to this example, which is a strongly coupled field theory. And the hope is that when this works, that we would go to higher dimensions and that the same structure would repeat. This was the original motivation also with the bootstrap, when people started seeing these kinks, when Slavoryshkov said, oh, there is a kink in two dimensions. Of course, we already know the 2D Ising model. But there is this kink. Try it in three dimensions, because if you find the kink as well, you solve the 3D Ising model. So we want to explore as much as possible this two-dimensional case, find what kind of structure we have, and hope that as we go to higher dimension, we can then study the 3D Ising model perturbed by magnetic field and by temperature and so on, which is, of course, very far from known. I don't know how many particles there are, what's its mass spectrum, what are its couplings. I think very little is known about it. And we are also developing this higher dimensional bootstrap from the CFT. And of course, there is also the pessimistic situation that it might be that as we go to higher dimensions, things get a little bit more complicated. From the S-matrix bootstrap, the main complication is that we start getting more than one Mandelstam variable. We start getting more variables. In particular, spin starts to play a big role. And similarly, as we go to higher dimensions, in a conformal bootstrap, spin also starts playing a role. We have no spin so far because we are in one dimension. And I mean, conceptually, I don't see why it should be a big deal. But there are some important differences. So it's not guaranteed that this program will work also in the dimensions. And the hope is, of course, again, that if we now start asking more and more and more questions, for some theories, we might get these avenues. For some theories, we might get islands. And that's the basic idea of this approach. OK, thank you. I don't know what's their meaning. For example, sometimes you have divergences, and these divergences typically come about when poles collide. So for example, we have this S and T channel pole, and as we said, they have opposite residue, right? So if the mass goes to square root of 2 is invariant under S and T. So now you have a pole with positive residue very close to a pole of negative residue. So if you see from far away, they are almost canceling each other. So you expect to find no bound, because you can make one very big if you make the other very big as well, because they are close to each other. So you expect the bounds to become very weak as poles are colliding. So these are their explanation is purely kinematical. You just ask, at which points do we start seeing collisions of these S and T channel poles? At those points, because of these cancellations, we expect the bounds to become very weak or non-existent. But these divergences are real. The Sine-Gordon model is one of the models that saturates the full line of the plot. And if you compute its coupling, it does diverge at that point, as you approach that point.
Is it related to multi-particle forces? Because you said the double pool is arrived at the double multi-particle.
Exactly. At that particular value, you have one extra diagram. So sometimes, you see, these diagrams are rigid in two dimensions, right? So sometimes you get diagrams where you form, say, a rectangle. And then they appear, they form for a second, then they disappear again. So there are special points where indeed you get new diagrams that you could draw. And for example, in this case, where the mass becomes square root of 2, it's one of those examples.
So it's a square.
Yeah. In that case, it's a square diagram, yeah, that appears.
All right, it's not this time, better again.